talking about the Ottoman Empire. We know that they were given a mission from Allah. The sultans were charged with spreading Islam and conquering all that stood in their way. Allah told Uthman that in a dream. Well, the Ottoman sultans would essentially wield the power equivalent to what in Europe are referred to as absolute monarchs. Meaning, they held absolute authority over their realms. The problem is that, as I'm sure we all know, one man cannot rule it all. And one man must have assistance. Particularly as the empire grew, and the economy grew, and the war machine grew, everything became more complicated. So, even though in theory the sultan sat at the top, in order to maintain his dominance, he had to play all of the various areas of political power against one another. He had to play politics. Because if the sultan could not play politics, any one of these groups could have resulted in his demise, his downfall. Now, he managed to keep everyone in line so long as there was war. As long as they were advancing and getting more, politics was not a problem. But when the empire reached the 17th century and they hit that wall trying to take Vienna, that's where the flaws of the Ottoman system began to be exposed. Because there were challenges. Challenges indeed. So, the sultans had to play games. They had to play each one of these groups against one another. The first influential group that could have toppled a sultan was the Ottoman nobility, which the Turks referred to as the Sipahi. The Sipahi were similar to European nobles in that, you know, many of them could trace their lineage back hundreds of years, over the centuries, like European nobles. They were rewarded with rights to claim land, and they could make their existence off of that land. They owned the peasants that lived on that land. They also reserved the right to serve as officers in cavalry in the armies. Again, very similar to the European dukes and earls and whatever titles you're going to give them. They also were similar to the Japanese bushi. Some of the Sipahi became very powerful. They had their own armies. And if enraged, they could have launched a coup d'etat similar to what happened against the shoguns. So these groups, as useful as these guys were always a threat to the sultan. So the sultan always had to make sure they got, for example, tax breaks. Or they were given more land. Because if they got pissed, there could be rebellion. There also was the Janissaries, which had to be dealt with. As the empire expanded, the sultan needed more of these shock troops. When Mehmed II was on the throne, the Janissaries only numbered about 7,000. But by the end of the expansion into the 17th century, you're talking 70, 80, 100,000 of these devoted, fanatical warriors whose job was to make war in the name of the Sultan. Any of you ever hear of the Roman Praetorian Guard? The Praetorians were the high honor in the Roman legions, and their job was to basically do the same thing as the Janissaries. Well, the problem with the Praetorian Guard is they sometimes would betray emperors. They would assassinate them. They would sell the position to the highest bidder. Because there would be a point in Roman history when wars stopped for a while. Similarly, the Janissaries, they wanted war. And when there was no war, sometimes they got their fingers into politics. And this could be a threat to the Sultan. Particularly if the Sultan did not give them comfortable livings, good wages, and so forth. There also was religion. Religion that the sultans had to deal with. As terrifying as the two warring classes were, the ulamas were as just a significant threat to the sultans as the other ones else. Because the ulamas were the guardians and interpreters of religious knowledge. These were not priests, these were scholars. Their primary job was to apply the Quran, which is the word of God, and the Sunnah, which is the sayings of Muhammad, and make secular law. In the Islamic world, there is church and state combined, but it's the church that dominates the state. These men had tremendous influence over politics because they essentially could say what is the word of God and what is not. And if you don't obey the law, word of God, you are a heretic, a blasphemer. And you could have a fatwa issued against you. So since they made the rules, they had a lot of influence over government. Then, as if these groups were not enough, the sultans had to deal with the viziers. Particularly once Mehmed II stopped going in public and started engaging in what was known as the sultan seclusions, the viziers literally controlled the state. How many of you saw the cartoon of Aladdin? Jafar was the sultan's vizier. And what did Jafar want? To take over. And that's essentially what he did. Granted, I had never heard of any viziers having like magical wands and all the rest, but you know what I'm saying. If you're going to have somebody ruling your kingdom, you have to be able to trust them. But if they become corrupt, greedy, self-centered, they could topple you as easy as pushing over a statue. And then there's all the government workers. These were the people in charge of fulfilling all of the different duties that the government engages in. So, from court officials to tax collectors to inspectors, if the government workers don't do their job, it's only a matter of time before the person on top is toppled. Because what could they do? Well, if they're tax collecting, they can skim off the top, which means the royal treasury receives less money, which means you can't pay the Janissaries, for example. Or they could be lazy. They could betray the realm. They had to be watched, but how can one man watch thousands and thousands of government officials? And then, as if that wasn't bad enough, you also had the scope of the empire. It was an empire, a kingdom that controlled other kingdoms. In charge of each of the conquered kingdoms, they had different provincial rulers. Some were governors, some were kings. But the one thing they had in common is they were all appointed by the Sultan to rule over that province. Same as the daimyo were. And look at what the daimyo did. The bigger this empire got, well, it's next to impossible it became to rule it all unless you had an alpha male sultan, someone who was hands-on. But like the dynastic circle, the Ottoman Empire would, once it reached its height, would kind of plateau and then slowly would begin to demise. Because you had sultans that were, in effect, beta males. They weren't like Mehmed. They were not ruthless. They were not powerful men. But they were men born into luxury. And like the last Ming emperors, they were content to sit on the throne and eat food and do drugs and be drunk and not actually run the show. Because after Mehmed II, the Sultan stopped going out in public. They engaged in what were constantly referred to as imperial seclusions. Mehmed literally took the best homes that were left standing in Constantinople and made it into a palace. And he surrounded his palace with fine things. Marble and lace and gold. Toward the end of his life, he spent more time reading books than actually going out and knowing what was going on in the empire. The one thing that made all of his predecessors loved by their people. During the reign of Mehmed's father, Murad II, any person who lived in, any Ottoman citizen had the right to go to the palace and have a meeting with the emperor, or the sultan. The sultan might not be available, but if you were willing to wait, you had a right to speak one-on-one directly to him. After Mehmed II, no more. So, as complicated as it was, keeping everything in balance, one of the big problems was the sultans stopped knowing what was going on in their realm. And as bad as trying to juggle everything was, it gets even worse.
Europe practices primogeniture. The oldest son gets the stuff of the father.
In Japan, it's the most proficient son, chosen by the father. In China, similar. But pretty much, the heir gets everything.
In Islam, there is no succession laws. There is no inheritance laws.
The Quran is silent. It does not say. So as a result, this Islamic state had no rules on who would succeed a dead sultan. So what ended up happening was every time a sultan died, the empire was under constant threat of civil war. not only amongst the sons of the sultans, but potential sipahi, powerful nobles, or powerful provincial governors. They all had the capacity to claim the throne. And as a result, you had the continuous possibility of civil war. So what ended up happening? Well, every time a sultan took the throne, he sought to wipe out all other claimants. There are stories of sultans coming in and, for example, arresting all of his brothers and executing them, killing them all. And by the way, under Islam, Muslims can have multiple wives so long as they can afford to take care of them. So sultans sometimes had 50, 100 wives. So imagine how many stepbrothers there are. Well, a sultan would come in and kill them all. What does that mean? Well, that means the most ruthless takes the throne, but might not be the best.
Questions? Well, if that was not complicated enough, the nature of the population of the Ottoman Empire also caused significant problems. The Ottoman Empire today would be referred to as a supranationalist nation, meaning there was no majority, ethnically, culturally speaking. The empire was actually ruled by a minority, the Turks, who ruled over Arabs and Jews and Syrians and Armenians and Greeks and Bulgarians and all of the, bless you, Egyptians and North Africans, all of the people that were conquered. I mean, literally, the empire stretched from Africa to Asia to Europe. So how do you maintain consistency? Well, you have to be aware of all of the different cultures, all of the different languages, all of the different religions. But the Ottomans did have an advantage, their capital. Beginning with Mehmed and his efforts to rebuild the city, he wanted the capital to reflect the diversity of the empire. It's called Istanbul today. It was called Istanbul after the Ottoman Empire fell apart, and Ataturk rose up after World War I and made the Republic of Turkey. He was the one in his group changed the name. But during the Ottoman period, it was still called Constantinople.
Well, this city, again, it was sacked, it was burned, it was destroyed, but Mehmed would spend the rest of his life rebuilding the city to its ancient glory. He ordered people from all corners of his empire to come and help rebuild it. Ironically, at one point, in I think it was like 1455, maybe 1460, there were actually more Jews living in Constantinople than Muslims. Because it was a bunch of Jewish carpenters and contractors that responded to the call. There were an abundance of Christians there as well. But the new city
would be different than the old. Many of the important historical and Christian sites were converted.
For example, the Hagia Sophia. The Hagia Sophia, up until the 19th century, was one of the largest cathedrals on earth. It was built by the ancient Byzantine Emperor Justinian II. No, Justinian I, sorry, my bad. In 537. This was a masterpiece of architecture. But it was the geographic heart of the Eastern Christian religion. Well, when Mahomet took the city, this building was converted to a mosque. And all of the ancient Christian murals were painted over. Question? No. He also rebuilt all the aqueducts so that way water could flow into the city again. And he fixed the defenses. He opened the markets. He wanted his capital to thrive. And each major powerfully, or well, let me strike that, each powerful sultan that came after it added to the beauty. They took the money that was generated and they built new things in the city. There were mansions. There were hospitals. In fact, in Constantinople were some of the first buildings dedicated to medical care on the entire earth. They built religious schools. They built gardens that were open to the public and libraries. And the city continued to grow. It grew well beyond the old walls and would actually cross the Bosphorus. And today, Istanbul has a major waterway going right through the middle of it, because it exists on both sides of the river, whereas back then it was only behind on the Golden Horn. And the beautification continued all the way up until the 19th century. Unlike some of the political leaders that we have in our country, the sultans didn't want to live in a dirty, crime-ridden city. Constantinople, throughout much of the reign of the Ottoman Empire, was one of the safest cities on earth. There was no crime. There was no garbage. There was no dirt. One of the greatest additions to the city was built by the Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent. This was a structure almost as large and as grand as the Hagia Sophia. This is the Suleimani Mosque. But again, it's based on the same architectural principles. You got a dome supported by counterweights of little domes to keep the big dome from falling in. Oh! And at its height, the markets of Constantinople, called bazaars, you literally could find anything you wanted on earth. If you could imagine something, you could find it there. Because the merchants still continue to bring some goods from Europe to Constantinople. And Constantinople sat at the tail end of the Silk Road. So you had goods coming from Europe, in Asia, in Africa, all coming into the city. And it could be procured in quantities unthinkable. Spices, ivory, you name it. And within the bazaars, One another thing that they were famous for is their coffee houses. Like how some neighborhoods, you know, like the barbershop is the local hangout, or there's a bar or a pub.
Because alcohol drinking is actually not allowed in Islam, men would gather in coffee houses and they'd talk politics, they'd gossip.
Smoke tobacco once the American colonies were founded and do business there.
And in order to ensure that this was an open economy, the Ottomans were the first imperial system to attempt to regulate their economy.
To do business, whether you were a merchant or an artisan or a cook, you actually had to go to the government and get a license. Exchange. So whatever you had to offer, if it was viewed as being equal value, you could barter it.
So it's just like a barter system.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So there wasn't any like form of money, like coins or something?
Not initially. It would grow to that. But maybe you don't have anything that the merchant wants to trade for. So what do you got in your pocket? Kind of deal. Pretty much, if you had something of value and the other party wanted it, that's going to encourage the exchange. So as I said, to do business anywhere in the city, you had to get a license. That license subject you to inspection. So they had like health inspectors. If you made food, they wanted to make sure your cleaning area and food storage was clean. They didn't want rats and bugs and infestation. They walked around with government scales to make sure if you're selling, say, a pound of wheat, your containers are actually a pound, that you're not ripping off the customer. In order to go into business, if you were a craftsman, you had to go through the apprentice process. Just like if you wanted to be a tradesman today. And you had to prove that you actually worked a certain amount of hours and that the actual artist, you know, approved, or manufacturer, service provider, approved of the quality of your work. And by the way, if you were caught fudging it, lying, not only could you have your license revoked, but you could be kicked out of the city. So, you had this imperial system that in some ways are archaic, but in many ways, you can see the seeds of modern society taking root in this thriving heartland of the empire. Questions? Now, religion also was an issue. Because commerce was open, not only could Muslims engage in business, but so could Christians and Jews. And they were subject to the same rules as everybody else. But there's a little thing to be aware of. In the Quran, it talks about essentially wiping out the unbelievers. Allah told Muhammad to literally to wage war and to cleanse the earth of non-believers. But exceptions were made for some groups. The Demi, the unbelievers, are allowed to exist so long as they are fellow children of the book. When Muhammad created Islam and created the rules and the foundation of the religion, he absorbed the Abrahamic tradition. So, for example, Islam acknowledges Jesus not as the Son of God, but Jesus was just one in a line of prophets that go all the way back to Adam. So, the Quran, in essence, acknowledges the Old Testament as well as the New. Except for those areas where, again, Jesus being the Son of God. And there's distinctions made. You know, certain people that are emphasized by the Jews or the Christians are de-emphasized by the Muslims. But the demi, particularly the Christians of the Jews, the people of the book, could be allowed to live. But they were not equal by any standard. And that is true today. If you are a Christian or Jewish, you may be tolerated in an Islamic country, but you do not have full equality as Muslims. Now, the Ottomans were no different than any other Islamic society. They actually put legal restrictions on Christians and Jews. The three that I always use. First, if a Christian or a Jew blasphemed against Islam, said something deemed as heresy, the penalty was death. And death could be brought by anyone, any Muslim who heard it. Although, interestingly enough, the same is true with Muslims as well. So, I suppose that's equality. But you can't say anything bad about Islam. Two, in the Ottoman system, you were not allowed to testify in court against a Muslim. Only Muslims could give testimony in court. So, if you claimed that a Muslim assaulted you, you could not actually take the stand and identify them. So it was challenging. And the third example I always give is murder. If a demi murders a Muslim, the penalty is death. But if a Muslim murders a demi, they had to make a blood payment to the surviving family members. The Muslim had to turn over half of their annual salary. Essentially, they had to pay a fine. But if it was the other way around, death. Question. Now, when the Ottomans were waging war to raise soldiers for the Janissary, they implemented the devshirm. But in times of peace, they continued to impose a tax on demi. So if you wanted to be a Christian or a Jew, you had to pay a jizya, which is a head tax. This was an undeclared amount. So you didn't know how much the payment was going to be. You didn't know when the payment had to be made. Sometimes you went a decade or more without paying it. But at any given point, a government official could come to your house and demand that you pay up to retain your religion. But if you paid the tax, you were not allowed to practice publicly. So if you went out in public, no crosses, no Stars of David. And I don't know how this would have worked, particularly for the Jews. They weren't allowed to speak any other language but Turkish, even in their religious ceremonies. So I don't know if how well Turkish translates or Hebrew translates into Turkish. I don't know. But if you were caught even saying your prayers in your native language, that could result in punishment, even death. This in part is why shortly after the conquest began, many people that were conquered slowly began converting to Islam. Because living under the legal restrictions made life tough. Having to pay money made life tough. So for some, it was just easier to convert. Which again, I know one of my friends almost got in a fight with a Palestinian, because obviously we have the situation going on in Israel. When my friend happened to tell this Palestinian, yeah, chances are you go back, your great-great-great-great-grandfather probably was a Jew. Palestinian didn't like that. It was a bad scene. But that's the truth of it. Most of the people in the Middle East were probably, their ancestors were Jewish or Christian at one point, because that part of the world was controlled by the Byzantines and the Romans before them. But once they were conquered, the people basically said, just sign me up. Now, there's no one reason why people would switch religions. Again, some probably because of the restrictions. Maybe some embrace the universality of Islam. If you're a Muslim in a Muslim society, you have full equality, full rights. And it's very powerful in terms of religious messaging. But others probably did so because of the pressures. Don't know. All I know is that when the Ottomans conquered Constantinople, I think it was 90% of the peoples in their empire, their territory, were Christian or Jew. And slowly over time that would change, but we're talking over the span of centuries. Oh, there we go. So by the 19th century, I actually have the numbers in my book. So by the 1800s, 60% of the population was Muslim, but 40% was still Christian and Jew. So it had flopped, but again, is what it is. Now, I do have to give note. This is something somewhat controversial, but again, it's based on actual fact. In Islam, there's an interesting little loophole, if you will, that allows Muslims to be sometimes more persuasive than they might be in other circumstances. It's known as the taqiyya. Unlike un-Christianity, or even the Jewish faith, where lying is viewed as a sin, In Islam, Muslims are actually allowed to lie if their lives or Islam is threatened. Muslims are allowed to lie to save their lives, and they're allowed to protect Islam. So what does this mean? Well, very simple. How about you tell about how wonderful Islam is to someone who's listening? Maybe that convinces them to switch over. The one thing that Muslims usually don't tell is you can't switch out. Once you're in Islam, you're not allowed to leave the faith. So, what ends up happening? Well, a nice young man who's a Muslim maybe becomes attracted to a nice young lady who's not. Well, he can kind of persuade her. He can lie, and it's loud. It's loud, because the moment she converts, she's in. Now, I'm giving you all of the extreme examples, but if you actually look at the historical record throughout most of the Ottoman period, for the most part, the Christians and the Jews were, for the most part, treated well. As I said, Mohammed II kind of set the precedent where he allowed a considerable degree of religious freedom, so long as they didn't try to politically challenge him. So if they submitted to the political rule, then they were allowed to kind of live and let live. As I said, when Constantinople was conquered, he ordered Christians and Jews to come help rebuild the city. During Mehmed's successors, when Ferdinand and Isabella are launching the Reconquista, purging Spain of Muslims and Jews, most of the Jews, when they fled Spain, crossed the Mediterranean, would allow to go back to Israel, their homeland. And it's estimated that by 1500, there were over 1,500 families living in Israel, all because the Ottomans opened the doors and allowed the Jews to flee from persecution. Because the focus of most of the sultans was the economy, was the political and military strength. And they weren't interested in imposing religion. But, of course, there were times when not so good. So, when we come back to the Ottoman Empire for the third exam, we're going to see that when World War I occurred, the empire imploded, but as they did so, they unleashed a genocide against the Armenian people, as well as the Assyrians and the Greeks. And about 2 million people were killed in the name of religion. So, overall, it was okay being a daimi in the Ottoman Empire, but again, it just depended upon what time you lived in. Questions? Alright, well, like I did with China, we'll set the stage for the decline, and then we'll come back and talk about how the empire died. Now, like China under the Qing, it took centuries, 2 centuries plus, for the Ottoman Empire to implode. One of the reasons was because the empire was so diverse, it was so large, that they could lose entire provinces and they could still manage to survive. And they had solid control over their empire because the empire was built on war. But once the war stopped, once the empire stopped expanding, that's when weakness set in. And the reasons for decline are similar to the things that we covered when we talked about China. You had powerful rivals that wanted to take chunks out of the empire. You had the Russians. You had the Austrians. You had the Safavids, who we're going to talk about in a few minutes. By the 19th century, Christians in the Balkans began to rebel. Greece broke away. Serbia, Montenegro, Romania. Province by province, they were removed. And then France took control of Morocco in the 19th century. They took control of Libya, Tunisia. The Italians came in. England came in. All taking chunks. And there was nothing the Ottomans could do about it. This occurred, again, for the same reasons that the dynastic circle occurs. You had government officials who became incompetent and corrupt. Money stopped flowing into the treasury. Inspections stopped occurring. It was cheaper to buy off an inspector than it was to actually run a clean business. And these inspectors took the money and put it in their own pockets. Like what happened in China, when the money disappeared, taxes went up. Wait to see what's going to happen to all of you after the next presidential election. If the government actually attempts to pay off the $33 trillion that we're in debt, and they keep spending and spending and spending, who do you think is going to pay the bill?
Taxpayers.
Which taxpayers? I'm like 10 years away from retirement. Guess who's going to end up paying for all those bills? You guys. You also had bad sultans. You had rulers that didn't even try to look at the problems. And again, I'm not trying to be political, but look at what has happened to our country in the last 3 years with the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. As long as, and also impacting us, is all of the rank and leaders down that sit in Congress. In both chambers. And it's whether it's a D or an R. Do you think any of those people want to help us? No, they don't care. They're not interested in actually governing. So when you have bad government, you get bad results. But hands down, the greatest threat was a power shift. Beginning in the 17th and 18th century, Europe becomes the most powerful region on earth. The great powers, England, France, Spain, Portugal, they come to dominate other areas on earth. They conquer the New World. They push into the African coasts. They come into the Asian trade network. As European economic and political and military might increases, it puts a tremendous amount of pressure on the Ottomans because the Ottomans are right in the middle. Europeans could beat them with technology. The Ottoman Empire became strong because they adopted the bombards. Massive siege guns.
They also armed their janissaries with matchlock muskets.
Smoothbore guns that could be fired by literally lighting a match on a fuse. And so when you pull the trigger, the fuse would come down and spark a pan of powder, firing the round. Well, by the 18th century, Europe, they switched over from the matchlock muskets to the flint muskets. So like a Zippo lighter, you spark it with a spark because you rub the wheel, which is the flint, or the wheel on a flint, which causes a spark and it causes it to light. Flintlock musket is more reliable. You can predict when it's going to discharge, so you can hold the musket on target more effectively because you know at what point when you pull the trigger, it's going to fire. The Europeans also switched over to light cannon. So instead of the big bombards, they had small 6-pound or 8-pound cannon, which could be loaded quicker. And instead of firing one big round, you'd get like 20 small rounds downrange. And that's not saying the technology didn't reach the Ottoman borders, but did, but the Janissaries wanted nothing to do with it. The Janissaries viewed European technology as a threat. So they wanted nothing to do with it because they felt that the Christians were dumb. But of course, as time went on, whenever the Europeans would fight the Ottomans who used to win the wars began losing the wars because the Europeans ended up killing more of them than the other way around. Because by the way, that's how you win a war. You win a war by killing more of the enemy. I already referenced this last class. Mehmed was able to take Constantinople in part because he made a navy. Well, in 1571, the Italians, with the Spanish, completely smashed the Ottoman navy. And they never sought to rebuild it. So just like that, the Christians would take control of the seas. We also covered this point. Constantinople was what once the end of the Silk Road. Well, once the Portuguese got around Africa, there was no need to go through the Middle East anymore. There was no need to do business with the Ottomans. You could simply go to Asia and get the stuff yourself. So, less revenue, less taxes, less reinvestment. And lastly, most historians who study the decline of the Ottoman Empire agree they thought themselves better than everybody else. You should take this as a lesson for all the rest of your life. The people who have a tendency to fail spectacularly are the ones who think they're better than everybody else. So, when the Ottomans refuse to advance, refuse to modernize, in the end, everybody pulled away from them, which in part contributed to their decline. Questions? All right, well, we'll come back to this point when we hit exam number 3. All right, the next round of powerful, powerful empires. Is the Safavids. The Safavids. March 10th. It was on a Saturday. Alright. The Safavid Empire would appear here, in the middle of the three great Islamic states that would emerge in and around 1500. The Safavids would actually last from 1501 until 1722. And it encompassed much of the age or the ancient land known as Persia. Today, the modern state of Iran. In fact, I think that's literally the next click. But at its height, it went into Iraq. And it went as far north as the Russian state of Georgia, and it went as far east as Pakistan. Now, unlike the Ottoman state, where there was a sultan who was acknowledged as the ruler, the Safavid Empire was actually ruled by a theocracy. Any of you ever see this word before? Theocracy? Unlike a democracy, which is ruled by the people, unlike a monarchy that's ruled by a person, a theocracy is a state ruled by God. Bless you. Welcome. Did I tell you guys why it's always important to wish someone God bless you when they sneeze? The ancient Greeks, as well as many other ancient people, believed that whenever you sneezed, that was your soul trying to escape your body. So, by getting a blessing, that helps keep your soul inside. Because guess what you're going to do when you die? You're going to take a last breath. So, a simple blessing keeps it inside so you can live a long life. All right, theocracy. Who ruled? Well, Allah. And unlike the Ottoman state, which religiously was diverse, in the Safavid Empire, they would mandate a particular form of Islam to be the religion of the state. Shia Islam. Anyone know about the division that exists in Islam? The two largest groups? Okay. We have, on one hand, we have the Shia, and we have a group known as the Sunni, Sunnites. This division goes back to the years of the 7th century immediately following the death of Muhammad, the Prophet. And again, this touches upon one of the flaws of the Ottoman Empire. When Muhammad died, he never said who should succeed him as the head of his empire. So, there was a debate amongst the powerful warlords and religious figures early on. Who should succeed Muhammad as Caliph, the spiritual head of Islam? Well, for the first four caliphs, there was no issue because all of them were related to Muhammad. Muhammad, I think, had 9 wives, and from all of his wives, he had many children. So what he did is he married his daughters to his generals. And it would be his generals who would succeed him. But upon the death of Ali, who was a cousin of Muhammad, there was a great debate because there was no clear male descendant. So, this is where the division occurred. The Shia and the Sunni. The Shia believed direct descendants in the bloodline of Muhammad is a necessary requirement to be caliph. Whereas the Sunni believe that anyone can be caliph if they are popularly approved. So if the people want them, that's who can be the head of the faith. Today, Shia are the minority. Only about 10% of the world's Islamic population adhere to Shia or Shiism. Sunnis make up about 90%. So the Safavids, in creating this state, believed that the only person who has a right to be the spiritual head of the religion was a direct descendant of the Prophet. Sorry, I'm just seeing what I got coming up. I think it gets redundant, but I'm going to mention it now anyways.
However, because we don't know if there are any true descendants of Muhammad left, the Shia believe that this figure is hidden. They refer to him as the Hidden Imam. But one day, the Hidden Imam will reveal himself. And when he does, he will take rule over all Muslims. And at that point, Allah will bathe the earth in hellfire and will burn away all of the non-believers.
And then once purified, the true believers will inherit the earth. They're very, very, very small. They're a small minority. So that's why I said about.
All right. So the Safavids, the people who would take control over Persia, they would come in and they would basically ban all other religions, including
Sunni, the Sunni form of Islam. It was kicked out, not allowed. It was illegal. And ultimately, by having religious universality, that's how they maintained control for 2.5 centuries. Other questions? All right. Now, why is it called the Safavid Empire? Well, very simple. The empire was founded by a class of people known as the Safavids. The Safavids were not a family. This was not a dynasty. But rather, the Safavids was a small, religious, devout sect who was dedicated through the teachings in a sub-form of Islam known as Sufism. Sufism is an extreme form of Islam. It's a mystic form in which believers become so devoted to the Quran and the teachings of the Prophet that they lose themselves. The I, the individual, ceases to exist. And they become completely devoted to the faith. Sufism was founded by a Persian nationalist by the name of Safi al-Din, who was alive during the 13th century. So Safi al-Din converted to Shiism, but incorporated elements of Persian culture. So the faith of the Safavids was unlike any other religion, even within the Islamic world, because it wasn't just Quran, it was also Persian in influence. His disciples were the Safavids. And the Safavids simply refers to them being the Brotherhood. Like a cult.
So the empire was founded by these people?
By these group of individuals who collectively had this very, very tight, extreme religious perspective. Yes.
Originally, the first disciples were like the disciples of Christ. They were men who were spiritual, who were religious. But from the 14th into the 15th and then into the 16th, the Brotherhood began to get stronger as warlords joined. And war and religion were intertwined. Of course, they did the same things that European warlords did. They also had intermarriages, political alliances. But soon you had this very powerful association that had the power to affect politics in that region of the world. They publicly proclaimed their allegiance to the hidden imam, and were prepared to make the state that in essence opened the door for his arrival. Now, FYI, just mean to go on a tangent. The leaders in Iran still believe this. And that's one of the reasons why they're trying to get nuclear weapons. And there are many scholars today, including Salman Rushdie, who believe that once Iran gets the bomb, they're going to blow up the earth to purify the earth in a nuclear hellfire. Because that's what their beliefs dictate that they do. Just FYI. Not meaning to add any other fears of geopolitics, but that could happen very soon, because they keep saying Iran is just a couple of years away from having a bomb.
And why did they make that connection? Well, once warlords joined the Safavids, they combined war and religion and would begin conquering in the name of their faith.
The Safavids became effective in conquering even other Muslims because of how they fought. They waged jihad, holy war,
War is violent. Don't think war is like video games. The goal of war is to kill. And if you are killed, there is no respawning. Right? That's the right phrase for respawning. But when you combine religion into warfare, that eliminates human compassion. Because you're not fighting war against another man, another human being. You're fighting somebody who is the akin to the Antichrist. You need to kill him to help save the earth from demonic possession.
So these guys, when they waged war, there was no mercy. There was no diplomacy.
There was only violence and death and conquest.
So within the span of about 50 years, they managed to piece together their entire empire. Conquering as far as Turkey, into modern Iraq, going north into Georgia, and going into modern Afghanistan and Pakistan. Because they were fierce. Sorry, I'm just looking at what I got left. And we'll leave it at that. We'll pick up with Ismail when we come back.
Questions? All right, so time frame. I will not be done on Tuesday. We'll definitely finish on Thursday. So what I'm going to do, because we're going to have our second exam, what I am going to do, because I also understand that spring break is next week, I want you to take it before rather than after. So in all likelihood, what I will do is I will open up exam 2 on like Thursday and give you like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or something like that to take it. Because I'm assuming that even if you do go away, most people don't go away for spring break, but even if you do, you'll be able to squeeze in an hour at some point over that weekend. So that way when we come back after spring break, I don't have to give you an exam on a Monday and say, hey, remember all the stuff we were talking about for those couple of weeks? So at least that way we can get out of the way. So if you've missed any classes, going back to the first exam, make sure you listen to the recordings, you get the notes, so that way you're ready for it. Also, if you're working on any of those chapter review questions for the 2 chapters that you can do, get them done, get them into me, I'll start logging the extra points. All right? And of course, if you play sport, any of you play baseball, softball? Okay, no one in this group. Good, that's easy. All right, we'll see you. Have a nice weekend.